now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're asking a question which is baffling fans and philosophers across the land. Are Chelsea actually quite good? We'll also find out which of today's guests went on a special bank holiday road trip together. I'll once again be begging someone to tell me that Manchester City might just drop some points in the final weeks of the season. And we'll take a look at the bottom of the Premier League table and the top of the Championship too. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have football writer and Sunday Times columnist Alison Rudd, a former footballer who scored 19 goals for Ireland, including doubles against Tunisia, Macedonia, Liechtenstein and Lithuania. It's Tony Cascarino. And another former footballer who was described by Scotland under-21 coach Rainer Bonhoff as a solid left-back who can play various roles in defence. Bonhoff went on to say that this player was tall, strong and very powerful. I think he has a very big future at this level. Gregor Robertson, what went wrong?
I don't know, Tom. I mean, I'm sitting here now. Listen to you. Take the piss.
I'm not taking the piss. It's a wonderful highlights reel of your magnificent storied career.
It was nice to hear that from Bonhoff. He won the World Cup at 22, he did.
Tall, strong and very powerful.
Nothing about technique or talent on the ball or anything there is.
I think he had a bit of a crush on you.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Seriously. No, normally most managers, you've got the kind of like, you can play various roles across the defence. That's that, you know. If you had a dating profile,
you tried
when
to convert
you were a football,
me to centre half. I think that was probably the start of it.
Never mind. Anyway, we're nearly there. The 6th of May. We've nearly done it.
I can't wait.
Really in the archives now. Anyway, to Anfield. And another crazy game for Jurgen Klopp in his final season. And we're going to come on to Liverpool and that crazy game and two people who were there for a very special reason. But I wanted to start with Spurs, just to talk about some football, you know, before we get into some of the nonsense of the day. Alison and Tony, you were both there, and I'm going to get onto that reason later. But I wanted to look at the idea of Tottenham's season and the way it's going. And, you know, there's always this suspicion with Ange that it might end up this way. You have these kind of press conferences after games against Arsenal where he talks about, I'm not bothered about corners, I know I should be, and then concede against Chelsea from corners and then get pulled apart by Liverpool yesterday. Alison, what did you make of watching this Tottenham team yesterday? Did it look like a team that were just tired? Are they kind of finding the limitations, or is it a little bit more worrying than that?
The latter. It was interesting because I was sat amongst all the Merseyside reporters who don't get to see much of Spurs, don't see them as often as I do, for example, and they were looking at me and going, what's that? What are they doing? What the hell is that about? And they were completely unimpressed and felt he was busted flush, Ange Postecoglou. There was none of that. I think we convey it on this podcast quite often. There's a sort of almost a love for him and his refreshing attitude and the way he is uncompromising, but none of that held any sway with the reporters on Merseyside. They just thought it was very messy football, naive football, no pattern to it, no real energy. You know, people were shouting out things like, is Emerson actually running away from the ball? What's he doing that for? It was like, and I think in some respects, it's quite refreshing to hear that view of it, because when you see a lot of them and you hear a lot of Ange talking, I think you're lulled into this sense of, oh, he's got a bigger picture. You know, he is a maestro and there are going to be dips, and he warned us there would be dips and that he wouldn't tweak his methods. You know, you take me as I am and the football I want. But there was, if that was an advertisement of where he's going to go, to turn up at Anfield and play in a vaguely attacking sense some of the time, but not bother defending very much at all. I mean, where did he think he was going? It wasn't a cup game against someone from League Two. It was a very strange approach. Yes, you're right, Tom, there was a lack of energy, but energy, I don't think it counts as an excuse at this stage of the season. He's got most of his players back. He did have injuries were a problem, but every team's played the same number of games. His team have played less than anyone else because they were not in Europe. So it's not an excuse that they're a bit tired. It looked like a very flawed experiment that might be coming to an end.
Interesting. Tony, what about you? What did you make of Tottenham?
I watched them at Chelsea as well on Thursday night. I was at the game at the Bridge. And Alisson used the word they're flawed. And it's quite easy to be lazy in this game and be generally go, they're a busted flush. You know, they've been found out. Lazy explanations. I saw an astonishing amount of play that was just really weird to watch. Positions of players that I don't... Like, take Emerson Royale. And it's not having a go against him here. He's a right back that plays left back for Spurs. He's on a one-on-one. He's been left with Mo Salah, but he keeps tucking in higher up the pitch, which leaves Mo Salah quite free a lot of the time. But also... Whoever was playing left wing, because it changed. You know, obviously it was Son in the second half and in the first half it's Brennan Johnson. But he came up against Trent as well. But they didn't help Emerson Royale when they didn't have the ball. So Emerson Royale was faced with Trent in front of him and Salah on the outside and then running in behind him. And by the way, Harvey Elliott was running in the hole just between the two centre-halves. And Emerson Royale was literally three against one. And I'm thinking, yeah, he might be having a difficult time and he might not be a right back. But boy, this job for he's getting, Liverpool attack was right side, right side, right side, nearly every time. Mm. And not once did I see Postecoglou change it to give him some help.
Yeah,
and people might point the finger at his performance. He didn't play well, but I thought, boy, you've got some job. You've got Trent, who's a very gifted player on the ball as well, and you give him freedom and he can get his head up, you're in trouble. And that was the thing I couldn't get, because the flawed idea is you're letting players of the highest technique lift their head up and find a pass.
Yeah,
in their system.
Gregor Robertson, founding member of the Ange Postecoglou Will Not Change fan club. What was your response to those bits of analysis from your colleagues there?
I think the thing that struck me over this weekend is, you know, is that the doubts kind of were getting ramped up and even questions about his future, which I think are wildly over the top and premature, is that we criticise someone for being an absolute dogmatist, and then we criticise someone like Erik ten Hag for being a pragmatist and having no identity.
Style.
Where's his idea? Where's his identity? And clearly there's a middle ground. But Ange Postecoglou isn't interested in the middle ground. And I think we just have to accept that. Like, I don't think there's any point in criticising him for it, because this is the way it's going to be. I think what he ultimately will say is, we need to get to a point where we can do it better. And like, I completely agree with a lot of the things that you guys are saying, and I agree that constantly inviting the opposition, particularly a team like Liverpool, to press you in your own third and like play out and kind of, I mean, it's like anathema to me watching it as a fullback or as a someone who tried, you know, occasional centre half,
trying strong, to do tall, powerful, yeah,
trying to do it. That trying to do that. The only kind of vague comparison I could draw from my own career is when I was at start at Nottingham Forest, Paul Hart was the manager and we always played a diamond, right, and I was a fullback, and the fullbacks were the only players who offered the width. And every time the goalkeeper, who was Darren Ward, got the ball, every opponent knew that he was going to ping it to either the right back or the left back. Everyone knew it. And we still did it. So every time the ball was coming soaring onto my chest, he was very good at it, there was at least one player closing me down, like, if not on my first touch, then like already challenging me for it. So this is what they're dealing with all the time. But against Liverpool and against a team like that are so dynamic and you know, they're identity is pressing, and they still do it. Like I don't know, I still admire, I kind of, there's still something about me admires it, and I think I think we can forget too quickly and easily what has happened beforehand. And we know, you know, there was that stat about the points all from the first 35 games, 60 points. Klopp's was 58, Arteta's was 50. Let's not forget everything that made Spurs so exciting and sort of new.
Yeah,
because of the last four games.
Well, that's what I was going to come on to, is this idea, and links to what Tony's point about Emerson Royal and those managers, Gregor. Is it the case that this is the start of a potentially long journey and that he needs the time and potentially the investment?
He's always said that.
To change the players. And so I was going to come on to an idea that, watching yesterday's game, is this the ultimate idea of that this Tottenham team only has a certain number of players who will be Ange Postecoglou players long term, Tony?
Yeah, to a degree, but I can't help thinking, and we were both there together watching it, that game was so close to being 6-7. There was chances galore. Mm. We're not talking about Liverpool taking four opportunities in a game. We're talking about Liverpool missing 10 great chances, really, which they was out, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
It was literally one attack after another.
Yeah.
And Liverpool's finishing wasn't particularly great. I don't know how you can think, even with the highest technical players, that you can be so brave in a style.
So you don't think, even if he had, you know, Manchester City's squad and he was playing that way, Liverpool still would have had a load of chances?
Well, I still think it's disjointed and quite disorganised. Mm. It's, you know, Man City is an attack, they've always had an attack-minded team, so have Liverpool. You know, and I've seen attack-minded sides like Manchester United at their very best, and Arsene Wenger's Arsenal, but they were still organised in the way they played. That wasn't... I'm watching yesterday and I'm thinking, wow, this team are giving chances between 10 and 15 every game. Mm. If you're just doing data on numbers of chances, you cannot win football matches.
And no team has conceded ceded possession more in their own third than Spurs this season. Mm.
But is that, again,
they've given up 7 goals as a result, and as Tony said, it could probably have been more. That's just a bad... I don't know, as I say, I think he's going to want to get to a point where he does it better.
I always think it's worth asking colleagues who support these teams for their views before coming on the show. And my colleague Nick, who's on the editing desk, has a Spurs season ticket. And he suggested, about this kind of players not being good enough, that there's an interesting conversation to be had around Son Heung-min in this team for Postecoglou in relation to the way he wants to play.
Can I make one quick point?
Yeah, of course.
Right. We all talk about, okay, players who aren't good enough to do this, okay?
So why are you asking them to do it?
Yeah, so why are you asking them to do it? My second point is, who is their most gifted technical player?
Madison.
At the team. Mm. So the player that can keep the ball better than anybody else is not in the starting lineup. Mm. The game changed in the last quarter of the game because Liverpool's substitution sort of backfired and Tottenham's improved them.
Yeah, well, that was Nick's point as well, is that they looked much better when Richarlison came on because they had a focal point in attack and a number nine. And that Son
went on the left.
Son maybe, as a wide player who needs to stay wide in this Postecoglou system, doesn't quite fit. I mean, it's a bold call, and he wasn't suggesting, oh, it's time to sell Son Heung-min.
No.
But just that it's one of the challenges that Postecoglou's got, Gregor.
Yeah, and he said that he's not going to be shy about moving on big players if he has to do it, if it's for the betterment of the team as a whole. They have kind of, you know, Richarlison's had a pretty tumultuous season. He's their only real recognised striker. So, I think we'll all agree, Son's better off the left. But
what you've got, hang on a minute. You've got a Tottenham supporting friend who would like Son to move on.
He wouldn't like Son to move on. He just thinks there's an interesting conversation to be had around.
That's a wimp's way of saying they think Son should move on.
No, he definitely doesn't.
They're too scared to actually say the word Son should move on. Oh, let's have an interesting conversation about it.
I promise he didn't say that. But just whether there's a point about Tottenham's players not being good enough to play this way.
The players are not good enough for the fullbacks.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
It's so important in this system, the fullbacks. Yeah. And they landed on one with Udogie, who's been brilliant. Pedro Porro has exceeded certainly my expectations like by 1,000,000%. I thought he was awful last season. I thought they had to move him on. Then you change the setup of the team, you mean you don't have to defend too much. And he's excellent at stepping into midfield. But still, I think they need competition. Certainly cover, but competition for fullbacks, because what is behind them is nowhere near good enough. Mm. Like Royal on the right, never mind on the left, is nowhere near good enough to play in this. Not many people will be. You're asked to play like as a number 10 at times, and be the fullback, and like then sometimes be the winger. It's ridiculous some of what he's asking of a fullback, and the same is true of centre halves. And again, behind Romero and Van Ven, it's a massive drop off. So they need to back up. I mean, I look at the rest of the team and still, you know, Sarr had... There have been players who for season after season for Spurs, have shown glimpses or played well for in patches and they've not sustained it. And I think we're probably seeing a bit of that again. Bissouma was started the season outstandingly. And then, you know, he was sent off and suspended and then he was away and he's just not been anywhere near it. Sarr's dropped off a bit as well after a really good start. So there's question marks about their sort of durability throughout the campaign. But they're good. They've been great players for them this season. I think Bentancur's a really good player. I think it's like the depth more than anything that they really need to, because when they've lost players, when they lost Romero, when they lost Maddison, it just derailed the season.
Right, let's get on to Liverpool before Alison Rudd throws another hissy fit about a Tottenham-related question, because that's what we really want to talk about. Forget Coogan and Brydon. It's all about the real road trip that happened this weekend. Cascarino and Rudd. You drove all the way up there together.
Didn't share the driving.
Here we go. And we're off. The digs have begun. Even your body language is
too
like,
long together.
You're sat too far apart. I actually sort of sat you on opposite sides of the desk, shouldn't I? Now, Alison or Tony, would you like to tell us the reason for this feature before we then get into the details? Why were you both going to Liverpool together for a feature? What's the idea behind this?
There's a lot behind it, actually. So there's the fact that Tony pestered the desk every 10 minutes for the past year and a half.
Yeah.
Since Klopp announced his retirement, Tony felt that he'd just love to go to Anfield before it was the end of the Klopp era, and if possible to get in the press conference and ask him a question. Because once he's gone, he's gone. He won't get a chance to do that. And it made sense for Tony and I to go. We're both Liverpool fans, and we found out.
And you used to get on really well before the road trip.
We always got on incredibly well. Our first ever game at Anfield, we didn't go together, but was the same game. It was the 7-0 in 1978 against Spurs. And so the game that we get a pass for Tony to come, as well as so we get an extra pass, was against Spurs. So we were both convinced it was going to be 7-0. Should have been. And weirdly, our favourite Liverpool goal is the same Liverpool goal, which was the seventh goal scored in that 7-0 in 1978, scored by Terry McDermott. And we spent from 9:30 till 9:30 in the morning till 9:45 yesterday in each other's company. And it was only when I bumped into Tony on the escalator coming out of the tube this morning that Tony says, I was sat in front of Terry McDermott and had a nice chat with him. He didn't even think to mention this. I'm going to be writing this up for the paper. He didn't even mention it at the time or in the car ride afterwards. Oh, my God.
And you'd driven him all the way there and back because there were no trains. So forget the football. What I want to know is, what were the snacks? Snacks, good chat about music, apparently.
Okay. The test of whether it was a successful road trip or not.
Oh, God, I'm worried for Tony here.
Tony Cascarino, can you guess what album I played when I was washing my hair this morning?
What, Talking Book or Inner Visions?
Which one, Tony?
Probably Inner Visions.
Yeah, well done. It was a successful road trip.
And that is, I didn't know. Yeah.
Thank God. Honestly, I was tense in there. Me and Gregor were like, oh, my God, the whole podcast is going to fall down here. Hey, but, Tony, you had a lovely day by the sounds of it.
Yeah, we had good fun.
It
was an idea that I put to James, the sports editor, and that I just wanted to see Klopp, and I knew I was going to get a question, and I was battling away, which I'm only getting one shot at this, the one bullet, and I kept thinking, well, I've got to watch the game because it may be game related, but I wanted a deeper question, and which was more about what does it take to be the Liverpool manager. Mm-hmm. And he gave a really long reply to that, which was really interesting, because I was thinking, I'm going to ask this question, and he might just go one word answer or two or three words, and that would be it. But he didn't, did he, Al?
No, it was a lovely answer.
Yeah, he went quite in depth about Liverpool. It's strange you're going to... What I clearly didn't want is a piece that I'm gushing about everything about Liverpool and what a wonderful place it is, even though I think that.
Yeah, yeah. We have enough of that.
Wanted to go there, but also give a perspective from being that fan that went in 78, the same game as Al said, talking about The car journey was hilarious, really, because I kept bringing up different subjects, thinking we went political,
yeah.
We went music, didn't we?
Then
we
went,
I think we had a food one as well.
Would you say you're better pals now or than before the road trip? Because you've known each other for a long time and worked together, but you know,
Alison Rudd.
Can't believe we've got a podcast in the morning.
It's easy with Al. It's easy to do stuff because she's
nice.
Incredibly knowledgeable on many subjects. And sometimes I get a bit embarrassed because I feel like she's more clever than me. Which everybody probably knows anyway. But it was good fun.
It was very good fun.
Well, you can find out Jürgen Klopp's exact answer to Tony Cascarino's question when Alison writes up this feature, which you can read on the Times website and in the paper this week. But actually talking about the football, one player I wanted to talk about, which Tony, you briefly mentioned, Harvey Elliott. Mm. So it feels like to me it's been a very good season of him, but slightly unnecessarily stuttering, I would say. It feels like to me whenever I watch him, this guy looks the absolute real deal. Why isn't he in the team every week?
Mo Salah.
You don't think they can play together?
There is another. He can play. You know, Klopp has used him slightly different positions, but generally he loves that right side.
Mm.
You know, he loves to come off that side, and whether he cuts inside with the ball or like he did for the goal yesterday, I think he's been the one of the standout figures for Liverpool this year because, you know, he started the season in and out, and when he was called upon, he'd come off the bench and he'd do something. And, you know, I remember him coming on at Crystal Palace and changed the game, the outcome, you know, by his performance. And, you know, a lot of other talk is about other youngsters, and Harvey Elliott doesn't feel young, does he? Even though he still is.
Mm.
So I thought it was a really good afternoon for him. Do you know what I really love about him? He always wants the ball. He reminds me of Ray Houghton, who I played with, Republic of Ireland. I've said that before.
Did you bump into him yesterday and forget?
No, Ray wasn't there.
It's going to simmer that one, I think.
But he always wants it. You know, you see that player that just gives me it all the time. Even if he, you know, because you get the grumbles at any stadium, don't you? Sometimes a misplaced pass.
Mm.
He always wants the ball.
Mm.
And he's not the biggest, but he's fiery. He's got a lot of energy. I just really like him, and I'm hoping along the way that he doesn't become that still squad player, because there's a time at Liverpool where when you're going to be number one, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with Mo Salah. That's still up in the air, but I still think there's a big future for him at Liverpool.
Yeah, Alison, what do you make of Harvey Elliott? As Tony said, still only 21. You know, not really been talked about in the England contention. Goodness knows we've got a lot of players with left foots who like playing on the right side of the pitch, but He does to me look like a future Liverpool star, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I think he's looked like that way since more or less he joined Liverpool from Fulham. I'm amazed people think there might be a problem with him and Salah on the pitch at the same time, because I think there was a period when them both being together, they had such great chemistry and understanding.
They often linked up, I thought they made
each other look better players. And when you're talking about Mo Salah looking better, then something's going well. I think it's probably to do with his youth, but he brings a sort of different sort of irrepressible sort of energy to the team, and he looks young, and he looks like he's still trying to impress. And I don't know if you can carry on being like that as you get older and more established, whether you lose that. Because that's the joy of him, is that he looks like, I'm just really happy to be here. Because his father's a Liverpool fan, and it feels like it really means something to him to create a connection with the fans. And he's as selfish as he needs to be when it's the right thing to be, and also incredibly unselfish when it's the right thing to be. So I don't think he's made a special case from this game, although I think I'm just looking, Paul Joyce, who did the match report for us, he gave him 9 out of 10, which is big marks. I think he's looked like he can work for Liverpool almost from the start, and I wouldn't have any problem always starting him and Salah together ever, and I'm assuming Salah will stay next season.
Yeah, he's only started 9 Premier League games.
Which is surprising. That's the kind of point I'm getting at. That's
23 off the bench. He's been a real impact player off the bench. Mm. That can sometimes be a hindrance too, if you're like, well, we've always got Harvey to throw on, and he'll come on, he'll score a goal. And
but some players are better at doing that. So
yeah, you don't want to be that, though.
You don't want to be that, what it means is, on the plus side of being someone who comes off the bench, you don't need very long to acclimatise to the match.
Mm.
You're going to hit the ground running when you come on. which makes you more valuable. Doesn't mean that you're bad when you start the game. It just means you can rely on him to change things when he comes up.
It's a little bit of a kind of grey area about his position too, because he plays in that advanced midfield role too, but he's quite diminutive, and, you know, compare him to someone like Szoboszlai, who's a real athlete, and I don't know. It's always been the engine room for Liverpool, that, hasn't it? Not that he can't do any part of that side of the job, but just, I don't know, it looks a little bit different. But yeah, I think he's been one of the best players absolutely all season. So for him, it's just about doing it regularly enough to cement a place in the team, and that's a big challenge at a club like Liverpool.
Too soon for the Euro squad, I assume. Anyone in the Euro squad?
I think this time.
I think it's a tough one, as you say, when a player's only started 9 games, even though when he has done and has come off the bench, he makes an impact. You know, I just don't think Gareth will select him on that basis alone.
Yeah, well, that win kept Liverpool mathematically still in the title race, but it will come down to Arsenal and Manchester City after they both picked up comfortable home wins against Bournemouth and Wolves, respectively. Gregor, you were at the Emirates for this game. What was the phrase you used before we started recording? God, they're bloody good.
Yeah, really deep insight there.
Had to turn that into 800 words on Saturday.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, I think as everyone does these days, you just kind of turn to Declan Rice because, my goodness, his influence. I said, I posed the question rather than necessarily answering it in this piece, but is there a player who's more influential in the Premier League just now? By that, I mean on the players around him, on the sort of energy in the stadium, on the opposition, on performances, on results, just his influence, his drive, his force of personality, and now his goal contributions. Mm. He's got a goal and an assist in this, brought them to 15 for the season.
And he could have had more as well. He's always getting
his
in
volley,
the box.
Yeah, in the first half, that was a sitter. It was getting a wee bit edgy in the first half because Arsenal were outstanding. Like, they suffocated them. And that's the other thing about when Rice plays in this more advanced role, which he's done in the last 4 games now, kind of left-sided number 8. You know, you think, oh, you're losing something about his sort of protection in front of the back four. But no, on the other side of that, you gain the counter-pressing ability he has at times where he just steals the ball back almost immediately after it's been turned over. He did that at the start of the second half for a really good chance for Saka. And then you saw those lung-busting runs where, you know, first for the assist for Trossard, and then in the 97th minute, when most people are like, you know,
he's desperate,
just taking a breather.
Desperate to sort that sitter out, isn't he, in the first half?
He's outstanding.
We'll come back to Declan Rice in just a second, but for Manchester City, turns out they've got some bloke up front called Haaland who can score some goals that we'd forgotten about of late. Tony, you wanted to talk about one of his goals in particular.
Yeah, the header.
Yeah.
The leap.
Cascarino-esque.
Well, that, I prided myself on that type of goal. I mean, I went into meltdown mode at the weekend on radio where I literally had a go at everybody who even considered that he lacked certain abilities to be a Premier League top player. I was just like...
Was this before or after he'd scored
goals? Before. I find it ludicrous that anyone would... You know, the guy is a physical beast.
But that goal is one that we don't see.
Well, it's a header at the far post that's attacking the ball and he literally heads it straight back in the other corner. Mm. And it's the one you're told and coached when you're younger that when the ball is coming from the right side, you attack it, you try and bury it in the corner that it's come from.
Yeah.
You, with power, it leaves the goalkeeper no chance. That's the goal I loved. Because it's one that very few keepers, you'll see not many headers do you see the ball go in before the keeper's moved. Mm. Most keepers can nearly get to a header because you don't head it as powerful. But he headed it like a bullet, which means the keeper gets nowhere near it.
And the leap as well. The leap is quite Cristiano Ronaldo.
Well, it's not as high, but there was many pictures in the papers yesterday of his legs. You remember that he's got to get leverage of someone who's 6'4", 6'5", getting nearly to the waist of the defender. That is really a hell of a leap because he's carrying a lot of weight to get himself up. You know, you think about me jumping, you know, even in my prime, it's harder for me to get that really high distance because I'm heavy. I've got to get myself off the ground.
Yeah.
Where Haaland, to me, was I do miss that because City don't do that as often as I was alike, where they tend to want to pull the team around and then feed it back or cut backs, but that was just a joy that
Put it in the box. They've got a guy who's quite good at scoring. Who knows? Yeah. Never catch on.
Have you stopped talking about the Arsenal game now?
No, no, I'm coming back to it. Okay. Just watch how I link it all back.
Okay.
Just bear with me.
I want to make a point on that one after as well.
So Erling Haaland outshone Phil Foden, who was, of course, named Football Writers Player of the Year. So I wanted to talk about both Manchester City and Arsenal in relation to Players of the Year. See what I did there, Alison? So we can still talk about Arsenal as long as you want.
Doesn't sound like
what did
like
you do to
her,
Tony Cascarino? What did you do on this road trip? She saw Liverpool win 4-2 and she's just jibing at me the whole time.
Do you know what, Tom? When it was 2-0, Alison's looking back at me and going, 2 and only another 5 to go. It's like this romantic notion that needs to be 7. I'm thinking,
that's
I'm
my
quite
problem
enjoying
with Liverpool
it. 3,
fans.
4.
Absolutely spoilt rotten. Anyway, I'd like to just briefly talk about who your Players of the Year would be after Phil Foden won that award, because I think Gregor, coming back to Arsenal and Declan Rice, you're going to make a change. You said Rodri a few weeks ago.
You're
not going to agree with me.
You're
going to
see I sit on the fence too much, but
you do.
And there's no right or wrong answer in this. But I think, as I say, I keep using that word. Like, there are more talented players, and I think there's often when we have these conversations, like, talent outweighs influence and impact on games. If you know what I mean, the player like Phil Foden, who's got all the wonderful kind of, you know, silky skills and touches and some great goals.
But they win
really
the title without him.
Easy on the eye. Well, you know what I mean, though. He's really easy in the eye, and often this happens, or it's a goal scorer. But there are other players who exert just as much or more influence. And Declan Rice is one of those people. It's part of it. It's his sort of personality. And you heard, Joe Cole on the TNT afterwards sort of compare him this performance to like Steven Gerrard, Roy Keane, Patrick Vieira, and you know, I think early in the season that would have seemed outlandish. Kind of, come on, Joe. But
is there not also
there's
something
truth
about
in that? There's truth in that. He could become that kind of figure for Arsenal. I honestly believe that. And this is his first season.
After moving for £100 million and now looking kind of like a bargain.
Well, they sing Declan Rice, we got him half price. That's our new song down at the Emirates. So like, I said it's more like they got two for the price of one, because you know he's an outstanding number 6 and he's shown himself to be an outstanding number 8 now.
So what you're saying is a few weeks ago you said Rodri and I said Declan Rice, and now you're saying you agree with me. That's what you're saying.
Saying that, yeah.
Yes, great. Tony Cascarino, you're not for changing. Ollie Watkins, still your Player of the Year?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, I could just say that, look, an opinion of different candidates, there's always going to be 3 or 4 choices at least.
There's
not one outstanding player.
No.
I mean, that's happened before with people like De Bruyne, where, you know, his season was incredible. I mean, just on Declan Rice, it's so much more interesting watching him play alongside Partey, who's coming to the team after a long injury, just allows him to go.
Mm.
You know, I was at the game as well, as I said, and watching Rice. And by the way, and me and Gregor were talking off air about this, that, you know, watching Declan Rice actually play the game, but when you're watching him live, you're actually seeing him getting the crowd up as he's playing.
Mm.
He's actually waving the players as the game's going on.
Mm.
And that was quite funny because, you know, he's really driving a lot of Arsenal.
Probably part of that improved Emirates atmosphere that we talked about so much.
Yeah, it's
this
much
season.
Different. I mean, the Emirates is a different place to go.
Yeah.
You know, that also incorporates Arsenal. And my point, I would say, and I've seen quite a lot of Arsenal of late, they are the team to beat next year, without a doubt.
Mm.
It's going to. I always
already
say City.
Calling it.
No, I've always said Fantastic. City was the team this year. Arsenal are going to be the team to beat
because
next
of
year.
Because of
you
the,
can see
the age profile as well of the players. They're like all 22, 23, 25, 26. They're in their prime or entering the prime. They've got a good like. This squad has got maybe 3 or 4 years of development as it is now.
Clip that up, Neil. Gregor Robertson, not the man who hates predictions, already saying that Arsenal are going to win the league next year. Alison Rudd. You voted for an Arsenal player for your Player of the Year.
You know, recency bias is making this room bloated.
It's Odegaard.
Martin Odegaard, because overall, he is the player of the season. It's not Player of the Weekend, is it? So
Odegaard had a difficult start.
Honestly, Tony, what on earth happened? Seriously.
Odegaard didn't turn up till
September,
October.
How would mine be Flavour of the Month? Mine's been done over the whole of the season.
Yeah. To be fair, you picked Ollie Watkins about 3 seasons ago for your Player of the Season. So. Alison, please continue.
Can you continue? Sorry, Al.
No, I...
She's got us all on edge now.
No, I like Odegaard because of the variety of things he brings. So I think he's a supremely gifted player, and his the vision he has, his passing abilities, accuracy, is allied to other qualities. So he's very unselfish. He's always providing an out ball. He's a very supportive captain of the team. I know you mentioned that Declan Rice is the one that sort of connects with the crowd, but he does that too. He does also go to the crowd and ask them to lift the noise. I think he's got everything you could want. I think he's versatile as well. And sometimes there are matches where that beautiful element of his game can't be expressed or isn't necessary, and he will do the grafting as well. So I think he's the complete footballer. And a lot of what he does, I think, is underrated. And Gregor just said, oh, he didn't turn up till when? When did you think he turned up? September?
Yeah, late September.
He wasn't not turning up. He was just...
Well,
He was still doing his thing.
We were asking where Arsenal's kind of flow and rhythm was, and he was his.
Well, if he wasn't quite at it, that just proves how important he is.
Don't poke the bear, Greg. Happy with that? Is that enough, Alan? Arsenal?
You haven't said the key point about the Arsenal game.
Which is
why on earth VAR exists if you don't
look at it.
No,
this is an important one.
It is.
Because Kai Havertz is running, and then he suddenly decides the way you run is that you drag your toes along the ground so that you fall over. It's the absolute clearest dive of the century. VAR looks at it and doesn't and wimps out, and therefore utterly makes it a useless concept.
My blood was boiling watching this. I said it at the moment. I was sitting beside Paul Rowan, who was writing the Sunday Times match report. I was like, that's a dive. And then we saw it on the screen. And I also said, the referee blew the whistle and he still didn't know what he was going to do. He blew the whistle and then he took 3 seconds maybe, and you could see him wavering. So he was between giving a foul for a dive to Bournemouth or giving a penalty, and he went with a penalty. And because of that, VAR couldn't because then they would say there's not a clear and obvious error.
Well, it was a clear and obvious error.
He touched them, so by the nonsense of the protocol,
dragged his toes into him.
And I completely agree with you, but by the nonsense idea of this of the protocol, there's enough to say that you can see why he gave a penalty. That's the warped state of VAR.
I know, it's very warped.
Lucky you didn't go in that car yesterday.
Yeah, Jesus. at least we know what Alison Rudd's really upset about now, and it's not Tony Cascarino.
No.
Hang on. It was the same with the second one though, because Raya came out and punched. It was a minimal thing, but because he gave it on the pitch.
Was that? I watched that one and thought, Gregor's going to come on and say that's the same as the Villa Chelsea one, the nudge. It's a fool, as he said against it.
No, he didn't touch him.
No, because he could still get up. He still got the punch on the ball. It's very different. That was like an isolated incident that led directly to a goal. He still got the punch on the ball, and he's not strong enough, generally speaking.
Billing was hauled to the ground.
Yeah,
but again, it's because the referee gave it on the pitch that VAR is essentially pointless.
So what is the So what's the point?
I'm glad we're all in agreement on that.
But everyone talks about this need. Sorry, it really annoyed me.
I can't tell.
Everyone talks about this need just to remember the clear and obvious. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. It will never exist.
We're carrying this till the end, Tone. Me and you. Alison's corrupted Gregor. Now he's in a bad mood. Me and you to the end. Anyway, if you're a football fan who presumably agrees with Gregor and Alison, let's hope you do about VAR. Or maybe you want to offer your views on who should be player of the year. You can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But for now, stick with us. We're going to have a very happy second half of the show talking about Chelsea.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and today I'm joined by Alison Rudd, Tony Cascarino and Gregor Robertson. Now, after an impressive comeback against Aston Villa and two comprehensive wins against Spurs and West Ham, Chelsea are up to seventh and could still, technically, maybe, who knows, finish fifth. So, Gregor Robertson, having slagged them off all season, it's now time for you to change your mind on this as well, right? Chelsea suddenly look quite good, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I wouldn't get carried away though. Personally,
you never would. But they, but it's promising signs, right?
Absolutely. I think some of their players have kind of developed quite a lot recently. I'd say Caicedo is one of them, and I'd say Noni Madueke as well is definitely one of them. He's been outstanding the last few weeks. He certainly was in this game. Cole Palmer's always been there. Mudrick's still non-existent, and Jackson. When someone's actually passes him the ball, you know, like in a decent goal scoring position, you can get a couple of goals. But I personally still wouldn't get too carried away. I think they still gave up some really good chances. I'm still not convinced about them defensively. Jared Bowen hit the bar three times. I think West Ham had 13 attempts on goal. I know it's a 5-0, and it was a well deserved comprehensive win. And the thing that you hear Pochettino talking about now is that they're maturing, and again, I'd say we're seeing signs of that. We're seeing like some signs of cohesion, like players who now know a little bit more about what it's like to play with each other. But
Gallagher and Caicedo, perhaps in midfield, which we have touched on before on recent shows, but it just looks a more and more persuasive argument that those two should be the midfield too, and that Enzo Fernandez and Caicedo might have cost 200 million quid together, but doesn't necessarily mean they can play together.
Yeah, but I mean, again, do you have much confidence in this, any of this progress not being undermined again in the summer?
What, by them selling Conor Gallagher?
By them selling people that they probably shouldn't, and who knows what they're doing with Pochettino as well. So, look, they've taken big strides in the last few weeks, but I still think there's some serious question marks about them.
Just on Conor Gallagher, he's a player that fascinates me in terms of his trajectory, having been in teams on loan and looking very good, then in this Chelsea team, you know, captain of this Chelsea team. What the hell does that mean? We talked about great captains and great leaders, Declan Rice, Martin Odegaard. Tony, what do you make of Conor Gallagher as a player? Is he a player that Chelsea should, in this age of FFP, pure profit as a homegrown player, maybe be looking to sell in the summer, or should they be keeping a hold of him at all costs?
Well, I always like to think players can improve and develop. And I think when he went out on loan, he got goals and he played in a certain way for Crystal Palace. He came back to Chelsea and he's been asked to be a little bit more disciplined. But when he's got Caicedo alongside him, and he doesn't have to be so reliant, because Cole Palmer will play often in front of him, will get in positions around the, you know, the edge of the box, and he can feed him. He's a really good player. I think there's more there. I've always felt that about Conor Gallagher. He's not complete, because Chelsea have gone for a very young project. I was at the game against Spurs, and I thought it was easy to say, you know, Spurs were pretty poor in the game. As Gregor said, Madueke was really good. He wants to take the fullback on. He wants to drive to that line, and he'll come inside. And the movement of Chelsea's got better. If we go to next season, if you think that if Jackson scores 20-25%, maybe 30% more of his chances, he'd have 20 goals. He could easily get 20 goals. He's had a season where he should be way above 20 goals with the amount of chances he's had. So he's only 22. I'd like to think there's a lot more improvement there. The whole of their back line's been injured nearly all season. You know, people like Fafanyu have not really kicked a ball.
Mm.
You know, there was a lot of money spent on him. I think certainly Chelsea can challenge for a top four next year.
Mm.
I think what we're seeing is the form of a team that, with a bit more improvement, can go again.
I love it. That's your second prediction for next season already. We've got
no,
two.
I know.
Arsenal are going to be the team to beat, and Chelsea could be in the top four.
As you know, I'm not really afraid of predictions.
Yeah.
I've done that a lot.
Thank God you're not.
But there is something that is way better. It's way better. And Chelsea are not even close to the finished article in any shape or form. I'm not going over the top here. There are lots of areas of the pitch where you think it's got to be, and Poch is finding his feet with his team, but you can sort of guess his side now, which is, you know, that's a big thing. If you can name the team that the manager's going to name, it's because we're all pretty sure that's going to be his best lineup. And he hasn't done that often enough this year, because I don't think he's really found his best lineup. He's suddenly, from Fernandes being out, Enzo Fernandes not playing, I think they're better, but it has Cole Palmer to be that Odegaard position.
Mm.
It does allow him to do that. Because, as we know, he can score goals in really very different areas of the pitch, Cole Palmer.
Alisson, in terms of players like Madueke and things, we've seen scenes recently of Pochettino, you know, chummying up with him on the pitch and things, and lots of the qualities that he had when he was Tottenham manager. Do you think there is a sense that it's kind of coming together a little bit for Pochettino after a slightly strange few weeks where he was having these mad press conferences and talking all about himself rather than about his team?
Yeah, well, I mean, if this was all happening in January, it would be like really quite beautiful, because they are coming together. They really are. And I was also there reporting on the game against Spurs, and it did feel like a breakthrough moment. Even Mudryk played well, actually, which is saying something. They were gelling, and they had an identity. There was a connection between the crowd and the players. They looked like a team. They were cohesive and fearless and fun to watch. But it might all have come too late, and it is slightly bizarre that it's taken till May for it to happen. So I don't know if it has come too late, but let's assume it hasn't. I think what we're seeing now is really positive. And I have been as critical about Chelsea as anyone, and I'm prepared to say, when it clicks for them, they I agree with Tony. I think they could be top four next season, because there's a lot of talent there. And I agree completely that Gallagher and Caicedo are a great midfield pairing. But Fernandes, I would say, I think he's been playing with a hernia problem all season, and he's not been fully fit. So there might be, that might not be just like, what a wasted experiment and a lot of money. He might still be able to bring something to the team, but yeah, I think this stage it's really in the balance whether they stick with Poch or not.
Just like a little reminder that they lost 5-0 to Arsenal 2 weeks ago.
Absolutely.
Mm. Like,
but Arsenal are bloody good, apparently, according to you.
So they are. They are. Then they played against, I was at the Villa game, and well, they played well. They still shipped two goals and had to chase the game back.
They did, but they were
excellent
in that
second half. a really below par Spurs and West Ham team who are on the beach, and you know, probably going to get their manager in trouble. So, I just think we've kind of had these glimpses before, and this is they have taken strides, and as I said before, we're seeing it in individuals, and we're seeing it in sort of like cohesion and units within the team. But again, we're talking about, as you're saying, a whole new back four coming in. They've not played together. Mm. They need a striker. They need someone who's like a leader at the back as well, I think. Because even amongst all those players we spoke about, I'm not sure there's like the steel there. So there are things that they still need to add to the squad, I think. But it's going to be interesting how they do it in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's Reece James is a big loss. You'd like to think they were a better side with him in the team. I would look at Fafanyu, and then I would look at probably Ben Chilwell can add more. Kukurea,
yeah,
by the way,
he's played
really, really well in the last couple of games I've watched. I don't think De Sassi and Badiashile are a solution for Chelsea going into next season, but I don't think they'll play. I think one of them might play now and again, but I don't think that will be the centre-half position. Colwell will probably be back involved. So I think it's a lot brighter than most people think. So I'm pretty optimistic about Chelsea. Right. And I have been for a little while. I mean, you mentioned going to Villa Park and 2-0 down, you know, that there's a lot about Chelsea that you can go, when they get it right and they move it quick, they don't need much of an improvement to be a top four team.
Brighter, but still uncertainty surrounding Chelsea. And there's definitely some uncertainty surrounding West Ham. As you mentioned, Gregor, there. Gary Jacob reporting on the Times website now that Julian Lopetegui is set to take over as manager next season, replacing David Moyes. Gregor, you said there about West Ham being on the beach. There is an element of that partly because of this uncertainty around the manager. What do we make of that situation if those news reports do turn out to be true?
You, big part of you has sympathy for David Moyes, absolutely, because he's, you know,
won them a trophy.
He won them a trophy. I was there. Like, it was an enormous moment for them and one that will live with all their fans for a long, long time. And I like to think that when all the kind of dust settles in this, that he will be remembered and, you know, more fondly in a slightly different light.
Lopetegui an upgrade?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, he did a brilliant job at Wolves when he came in. Kind of making them really well organised. You could see, you know, evidence of his coaching on the team. But if it's the kind of step change that you want for West Ham to be a club that are competing for Champions League football, and there's no reason why West Ham should not have those aspirations with the size of the club, the size of the fan base, the size of the stadium. That season when they won the European trophy, I remember there was a stat where there were only like two teams in Europe had more teams, more supporters in the stadium. That so like the potential is undoubtedly there. I just don't know if the step change is Lopetegui. I remain to be convinced about that because of what they want to see is more excitement, more expansive football. I don't know if that's what Lopetegui is.
Alison, what do you make of the West Ham situation as we head towards the end of the season?
Well, I think there's a bit of a case of let's go for a foreign coach because don't foreign coaches bring something with a bit of flair? And for some reason, the word flair has never attached itself to David Moyes. But I also think it's going to be easier for fans to accept the change because I don't think they're all in unison on thinking they want Moyes out. I think some like Gregor are grown up enough to think, oh, I remember how happy I was when we won that European trophy. It wasn't that long ago, was it? And if you lose 5-0 a couple of times, is that really worse than losing 1-0 a lot more often? No, it's not. It just looks more embarrassing in the moment. Overall, his overall body of work, given he's lost Declan Rice, and I thought that's where you were going to come back to Declan Rice, actually, because that's the reason David Moyes gave for the 5-0. We don't have Declan Rice. And it was a big loss for him to absorb. And like many managers, he's also had injury issues. But I think it's just so easy to think, oh, you know, he's done as well as he can, Moyes. He got them the European trophy. It's now after you've done that, you sort of have earned the right to not only you've won something, you then want to be entertained a bit more. It's just slightly lazy to think, well, that'll happen if we change the manager. And, oh, if he's a foreign manager, it'll be easier. I don't know. This is this weird mindset we have in this country where it's a safe bet to go to someone whose CV is actually quite limited in Premier League football. I agree with you. We did gush about him slightly on this podcast, Lopetegui, but his CV in Premier League football is quite limited.
Yeah, changing manager is the clearest path to a change in the style of football. What I'm saying is I'm not sure that Lopetegui is the guy who to give the fans the football they want.
Mm.
But there are arguments for changing David Moyes, and I think probably just about a majority of the fan base will support the decision while still feeling kind of in the weeks and months ahead real affection for David Moyes and what he did, and you know, A, saving the club from relegation twice, B, making them, you know, look at a season where they finished between 10th and 12th and be disappointed now all of a sudden, and C, having that night in Prague.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, West Ham fans, if you've got views on the change in manager, or maybe you want to say your happy memories about David Moyes, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Gregor, you mentioned relegations, and that brings us to the final segment of this show. Nottingham Forest putting some much-needed space between them and the bottom three with a win against Sheffield United. That win meant that Sheffield United became the first side to concede 100 goals in a 38-game English top-flight campaign since Leicester City in 1908-09. When they conceded 102. And Sheffield United, frighteningly, have got two games left to go to top that record. Gregor, this is, I think I know the answer to this, but has this been the worst season for any team in the Premier League era after promotion?
It's got to be.
As the man who basically teed it up that this was exactly going to happen in pre-season.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be. And, like, again, I wouldn't really lay any blame at the door of the players. That sounds ridiculous, but they weren't ever given a chance. They weren't supported by adding, you know, some more talent to the squad in the summer. In fact, they lost it. I wouldn't lay any blame at Paul Heckenbottom's door either, because what he achieved in getting them promoted despite all the off-field issues and stuff the season before was remarkable in the first place. And I wouldn't lay any blame at Chris Wilder's door, because he came into what was already a sinking ship and he tried his best with his kind of force of personality to do something about it. And it's not really happened, apart from a very brief spell at the start. Mm. The blame lies with Prince Abdullah, their owner, whose stewardship of the club has been absolutely shambolic. Mm. Like, I think there's 18 players out of contract now.
Yeah.
Like, how do you ever let your football club get to that point? Mm. I remember the day I was,
and loans to go back.
The day I was there, just in the week before pre-season, he'd also said that, he'd said on a fan podcast kind of YouTube channel thing, that's the kind of interviews he gives, he doesn't do anything with local press or anything, he said that he thinks players only play at their best when they're in their final year of the contract. And a lot of the players who'd just gotten promoted, obviously, now that they're in the final year, had 2 years. So imagine you're a player thinking, sorry mate, we were on the verge of administration. We've just, despite all the things like us not having any undersoil heating, or like having cold showers, or there being leaks in the roof, the staff not having any like Y Scout or anything like that, you know. No bills being paid. Despite everything, we've just probably doubled the value of your football club by getting promoted. And you say this. So now, the overhaul that Sheffield United are looking at this summer is vast.
Mm. Tony, Chris Wilder is someone that you know quite well. How will, and when he came in, you know, it was with the idea that not just to potentially pull off a miracle and save them from relegation in the Premier League, but to look forward as well. With everything that Greg is talking about now, they're in a slightly perilous state in terms of the future for next season in the Championship, which is an incredibly competitive league with a lot of talented teams and talented managers.
Yeah, well, I know, because I've spoke to him about this, that everything's already been put in place for next season already. With, like Gregor talked about, players coming out of contract, an idea of how they can bounce back from next season and all the issues that they've gone through this year. And there is a clear, I mean, Alisson, Gregor, we could all see that from the start of the season, the problems that laid on them for the rest of the season was that Heckenbottom had the same issues. You know, you just had a squad that wasn't good enough. I was, because I have a bit of a dark sense of humour sometimes, I was going to message Chris and say, just go home and watch a good film, Chris, 102 Dalmatians. but I don't think he'd appreciate it.
I'm not sure. Maybe give it a couple of weeks for that game.
No, look, I think he knows, and I know that things are being put in place.
Right.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work. But they've also got loanees as well that have been at the football club. So it's a huge challenging process. He's been there before. He was there in League One when he walked into the club and had a lot to deal with. So he'll think he's capable of doing it. He's a very enthusiastic, positive guy in many ways. And sometimes he needs to be calmed down, Chris, because he'll openly admit, I'm losing a game 3-1, but I'm going to try and lose it, or I'm going to try and get back to 3-3. Funny enough, they had an enormous amount of chances against Forest. They could have been home and dry at half time. Mm. And he'll reflect back on that. And how have we not got a lead that?
Yeah, they're just not good enough. It's the many number of times where, Like, you've seen someone, a defender, just panicking because they know that the player they're facing is going to have the better of, going to have the better of them. And that just, in both boxes, they just weren't good enough. That was clear from the start of the season. So
the Fulham
it's not
game
their
at
fault.
Home as well. 3-1 up, were they?
Yeah.
Probably should have been 4 for VAR. Let's not get into that. But in relation to the teams who are going to be replacing them, Ipswich secured their promotion from the Championship, a remarkable story. But I wanted to look at that promotion in relation to the relegation zone now, with Luton, Burnley and Sheffield United looking like they'll probably be 3 teams up, 3 teams straight back down. Is the Premier League got harder? Are those teams probably the 3 worst equipped? Did they have, naive tactical approaches? Perhaps Burnley, Alisson, I'm looking at you, something that you said lots of times. How should Ipswich and Kieran McKenna be looking at next season in light of the 3 teams that have just had a crack at it and almost certainly failed? Gregor?
I think the hope for them will be that they have so much momentum and they've signed players along the on their journey from League One to the Premier League with a higher ceiling than probably even the Championship. Like I mentioned a couple of my pieces today, Nathan Broadhead from Everton. They paid like $1.5 million for him. He'd been at Everton a long time and kind of not quite got an opportunity. There's a feeling that he could probably step up into the Premier League and do something. Same with Leif Davis, same with a few others as well. And, Wes Burns is another who, he's been around so many clubs in lower leagues. Aberdeen in Scotland, he came from Fleetwood Town in 2021. But you watch him, you watch the way he's taken the Championship by storm in his first full season at the level. You think there's just that momentum. It's a bit like Sheffield United under Chris Wilder the first time, when they did it in 3 seasons, didn't do back-to-back. They went up from League One, they had 1 season kind of consolidation, and they went up again. But there was still a real core of players from the League One promotion that stepped up in the first season. What did they finish? 9th? In the Premier League?
Yeah, mid-table.
Something like that. Yeah. It was I kind of think there's a chance that we see Ipswich do something like that, but if they keep the same kind of group and obviously add to it. And there's no way, again, there's no way that they'll kind of... The only way they've tweaked their style of play from the League One to the Championship is that McKenna acknowledged that it was a far more athletic, dynamic league. He went into real detail, even things like the amount of time the ball's in play. It jumps by like 5 or 6 minutes between those leagues. So he knew that he had to have a really athletic team. And look, you'll know that there's another big step up to the Premier League. When they have the ball, they ceded a bit more possession in the Championship too. So he's just a really intelligent coach, and I think the fundamentals about how Ipswich play and how they want, some of the stats in the piece about they've outscored every team, even on goals per game, because obviously there's more games in the Football League than the Premier League. I think there's only the top 3 in Liverpool, Arsenal, Man City. Who've scored more goals per game than Ipswich. They will be a threat going forward.
Alisson mentioned flavour of the month and ideas earlier on, and we're looking back at one season. This season could be a one-off, where, in my opinion, that's what it will be. Many teams have stayed up. This idea that 3 teams go down and it's going to happen regularly from here on in, I just think is nonsense. I think it will be, this is just a one-off season that, a lot of times over the last 10 years, yes, teams come up and get relegated again, but we haven't had that scenario of 3 of them going down, which is possible this year. I'd like to be a bit more optimistic that we'll look back at this period and go, no, it didn't end up panning out that way year by year.
I think the only way we'll look back on this period is if there's a change in the distribution of money from the Premier League downwards, because there's teams who have been average who have competed the next season just because of Premier League parachute payments. You could almost argue Sheffield United were one. Look at all the mess that they were in. And the fact that they could hold on to the bulk of their squad from the Premier League meant they were going to have a chance, and they could put all that to one side. And Norwich have done it. It's like, you almost don't have to be that good. You don't have to be that smart anymore if you have Premier League parachute payments to be in with a really good chance of bouncing straight back. I'm not saying it's going to happen every year, but what they were competing with, Ipswich's turnover is like 20 million, and the parachute payment's 43.
Yeah. 43
but I was
million.
Talking the other way, Gregor. I was talking about teams going up and then coming back down. You know, like Ipswich are going up this year. There's not, you know, this year we look like we could have maybe all three getting relegated if we got promoted.
Yeah, there's context in everyone. Like Leicester, you would imagine, you know, Leicester have been a team that have been able to cement their status in the Premier League, and you would imagine that they'll have a good chance of doing that. Even if Leeds go up, if Southampton go back up.
It's not easy.
The gulf is undoubtedly bigger.
One final point that I wanted to make in relation to this, which leads us back to the very starting topic of this podcast about Tottenham and changing styles. And Alison, I'll come to you on this, because in the Championship and across the football pyramid, there's such a desire to play a certain way and to play wonderful attacking football, which Ipswich have definitely done this season. But Alison, of course, you saw them undone by the mighty Maidstone in the FA Cup. And you've been a big pusher of Burnley maybe adapting a more pragmatic approach after blowing the Championship away last season. Do you think that might be a factor? We've seen many teams come up before, Chris Wilder, Sheffield United being one of them, who are very solid, very hard-working, still play good football at times, but that's not the be-all and end-all. And that these teams maybe come up with this desire for wonderful football and don't, as we were saying with Tottenham, have the quality to play like that way in the Premier League. So could that be a problem?
Yeah, no, you see, so it used to be that the qualities that got you to win the Championship were not the qualities that you'd need in the Premier League. And those qualities were athleticism and stamina.
Speed.
And good management. And then you'd get to the Premier League and you think, oh, we're lacking the ability to cope with tiki-taka or whatever was the flavour of the month. It's just a level above in terms of technical skill. And a really weird thing has happened. I think it's the weirdest thing I've ever seen in football, is that Burnley managed to win the Championship playing pretty, very pretty football, stylish football. And so a lot of people were seduced into thinking, well, they'll acclimatise better than anybody in the Premier League because that's what you do there. But it's almost inverted. So in the Premier League, you need to be able to have all the technical ability, but you need to be such prime specimens of athletes as well, that that's the gulf. It's having all of it. So you can still play pretty football in a Championship and win it, and yet look like you haven't got 90 minutes of football in you when you've come to the Premier League, and you haven't got the standard of skill. You've got relatively good technicians, but compared to what there exists in the Premier League, you're made to look naive and so on. So I do find that fascinating, that what you contain to get promotion, it's all about what you do with it to stay up, which is why one reason I'm a big fan of Thomas Frank, who we talked about a lot yesterday, because
sounds like you talked about everything yesterday. To me.
Because I still think I'd rather him than Arnie Slot was the next Liverpool manager, because we've seen what he can do. Because you need a really clever coach to take the best bits that got you promotion and to adapt to the Premier League. And that often just means, you know, how you set up in against specific opposition.
Gregor, final word from you on that point, and Ipswich and Kieran McKenna being that clever coach, that can take Alisson's points and adapt and still keep what they are.
Yeah, Burnley's a good reference point, in fairness, because they took the Championship by storm, and, you know, we had this conversation in the preview show, didn't we, about how Burnley were going to adapt or kind of, you know, evolve at all, and they didn't really. But it does come to, and the athleticism and you know, the physical aspect of the step up is huge. Again, you watched Burnley's defending against Newcastle, and there was I think it was Callum Wilson was wrestling with someone going to the byline, and you just thought, this is an absolute mismatch. Like, there's been so many moments like that where they're just not on the same level physically. And look, what I'm saying is, Kieran McKenna is someone who clearly does his homework, and he recognised that from the step up between League One and the Championship. And yes, this is a bigger step up, but he highlighted the things that he needed to change about his team and changed them, and that made Ipswich one of the best teams in the league above. I'm not saying that's going to happen in the Premier League, but I think he has a pretty sharp mind, and he'll know what he has to change about his Ipswich team and what he has to keep the same.
Absolutely. And congratulations to Ipswich fans as well. That's the second podcast in a row where I've talked about your promotion in slightly negative terms, but very well done for making it to the Premier League. Congratulations too to Bromley, who booked their EFL place for the first time in their history after beating Solihull Moors in a penalty shootout. Alison Rudd, Tony Cascarino and Gregor Robson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Thursday.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.